Eric Burns joins us on Sports Byline, the former outfielder who played 10 years in the majors with Oakland, Colorado, Baltimore, Arizona, and Seattle. And he was ranked in the top three for best defensive left fielders in the Fielding Bible. And you see him now on the MLB Network, and he does sports talk radio as well. And he is a guy who loves baseball and even in retirement is working to make the game better, which we'll talk about. And it's safe to say he is very, very interesting as a person as well. Eric, you relied on your speed and hustle. So is it fair to say that you were a grinder when it came to baseball?
Yeah, I think it probably transcends baseball, though. I guess you could probably say I'm sort of a grinder in life. So it's something that my parents instilled in me in an early age. And I think probably the way they did that was by letting me be myself. And so now as I'm a parent, I have three young children, 5, 6, and 7-year-old. And it's like the only thing I could think of as they're going through life, as much as I want to try to influence them and, really have this impactful mark on them, I also have to think back to what I was like as a kid. And really, you can't instill that sort of attitude, Ron. You just have to give them every opportunity that you possibly can. So that's something that my parents, I think, because of the liberty that they gave me as a kid, it allowed me to find my own path and then also find my own passion.
Tell me a little bit about growing up, because you did have some challenges as far as focus and everything as a kid. How did baseball play into your life?
No, it's interesting. I mean, you mentioned the challenge of the focus because I was probably one of the first to be diagnosed with ADHD. And back then, they didn't really know what it was. They didn't know how to treat it. It wasn't like, hey, here's all the Adderall and Ritalin and tossing it out like Tic Tacs to the kids like they do these days. They tried to prescribe me coffee. And my mom was like, you want me to give my 9-year-old kid coffee? Like this isn't going to happen. So I tried it and I wasn't interested, but what I did find was that the more active I was, the more focused I became. So as I would go to recess and we'd have a 10-20 minute recess, and I'd come back, I'd be able to sit through class for a little bit. And then I'd go to lunch, and I'd come back after lunch, and after running around for an hour, my focus would be there. And then after an extended period of time of sitting down, I would lose it. And I literally remember thinking to myself, like, man, if I could make it through a day without getting kicked out of class, like that was a success for me. And that's obviously why they had concerns they figured I had some sort of learning disability. They didn't know what it was. You know, immediately they gave me an IQ test and we're just like, no, this can't be the same kid. Like this doesn't make sense. And then that's when they came up with the ADHD diagnosis, but I was left to cope on my own. And I think that through life, like, you know, I think we all have a little ADHD in each and every single one of us. Some more extreme than others. And I'm not saying that some shouldn't be treated. And you know, I think it goes on in each individual case, but at least in my case, I think my ability to focus now on a task at hand, be it doing television or radio, is a gift that I was able to develop through the years, and that was done without all the artificial stimulants and whatever else.
When it came to playing the game of baseball, did you have to compensate in any way because of that?
It's a good question. I think at times, like, where it really hit me was in the outfield, when you're standing around and it's, you know, the fifth inning, you haven't had a ball hit to you, and I was really, you know, the hyperactive element of it was I couldn't sit still. So I just needed to keep moving. And I felt like people look at it as some people at least would look at it as a bad thing. I never looked at it as a bad thing. It was just something I would do. But the reason why I was doing it was because it was making me feel better. And it would lock me in and it would dial me in and allow me to be able to focus through the course of a three and a half and sometimes even 4-hour game.
I thought it was funny. Your former manager with the Oakland A's, Art Howe, once described you as playing with your hair on fire. What did he mean by that?
That's probably pretty accurate. I was all over the place. I energetic, obviously. I always had speed, so I think that played into it. I was always awkward. I had body limbs, flying in every different direction. I wasn't pretty to watch play. I wasn't graceful in the outfield by any means. So I think, when it comes down to it, you think about somebody who actually would be playing the game of baseball with their hair on fire and just crazily running around. That was me. But there was, as crazy as it was, I felt like I was able to put together a pretty decent career through all of it. And again, when it comes back to just focusing, on the right things at the right times and figuring out what I needed to do in order to be productive, not only on the field, but since, off the field and getting into a career in the media, it's totally, it's as much of a challenge, if not more of a challenge, at least from the mental side of things.
You grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area. You played football and baseball in high school against Tom Brady. Now, we know what kind of football player he turned out to be, but what about his baseball skills?
Well, I think it's ironic that, look, I played against Pat Burrell as well.
Right.
And so Pat Burrell, who hit over 300 home runs in the major leagues, ended up being the first overall pick in the 1998 draft. He was a quarterback of Bellarmine Prep. And when I saw him throw football for the first time, it was just like my jaw dropped. I remember it was pregame. I think he, at the time, I might have even been a sophomore, or excuse me, a junior. He was a sophomore. And I'm watching this dude throw like 60-yard bombs, perfectly tight spirals and warm-ups, and thinking to myself, like, wow, right? And not to mention the fact he's an imposing figure, 6'4", 6'5". And so we went out, we played him. We would scrap with Bellarmine. But St. Francis was a football school, and that was a school that I went to. And then here was Tom Brady. And we played Tom Brady, and I think the score was 63-6. When we played them when I was a senior and Tom was a junior. So think about that. 63-6. We sacked him six times. And it just, you can't throw a football from your back. So you really have, I didn't have a great gauge on Tom. Like, I knew Tom was putting up some numbers when we weren't playing him, because you'd do the scouting reports and you'd see and you watch the film and you're like, okay, he's cutting up Hillsdale High School, but so what? And then you would just get to the point where we would out-athlete them, and we had better athletes on our team, at least better football players than Sarah did. So it, as far as Tom was concerned, Tom didn't really have a chance. Now, my senior year of high school, I caught, and I'll never forget this. Tom comes up, he's a left-handed hitter, left-handed hitting catcher with an absolute cannon, right? He hit a ball so far. It was the furthest ball I've ever seen hit in high school. It went across the street and landed on top of this building. And I'd never seen another ball land on top of this building. And here's the totally ironic thing of all of this, is that, and I don't know what's more ironic, is that Tom Brady, the greatest quarterback who's ever lived, in my opinion, and I grew up a Joe Montana fan, so that's a bold statement, but Tom Brady, the greatest quarterback who's ever lived, hit the furthest ball I'd ever seen hit in a high school baseball game, or the fact that that ball landed across the street on top of a Planned Parenthood building across the street from my Catholic high school. So that right there was totally like, what? Anyhow, it's something that, I think Tom undoubtedly, and we have this conversation with Kevin Euclid all the time, who married Tom's sister. I think undoubtedly he could have played in the big leagues and had a long career.
We have about 50 seconds before we have to break here, but you go to UCLA, have a great career down there. You're in the UCLA Hall of Fame. You had a chance and were drafted twice, but decided to stay. You went on out of high school into college and then stay in college the full term. What was behind that decision?
Just, I'm prioritizing what's important in life. And I think at that point, I realized that either I'm going to make it or I'm not. And if I sign after my junior year, fine. I felt like if I signed after my senior year, I'd have just as good of a chance to make it and an opportunity to go and finish college. And that's that was a lot more important to me. And not only that, just the lifestyle and living with the guys. And I would probably, in my opinion, one of the greatest decisions that I ever made was going back for my senior year.
Eric Burns is with us. He played 10 years in the major leagues. We're going to talk a little bit more about his decision to retire from baseball and also about something that he is involved in to make the game better from an officiating standpoint. We do that as we continue across the country and around the world on Sports Byline. Eric Burns is with us here on Sports Byline USA talking about his career in Major League Baseball. You know, when an athlete goes through especially double-digit years in their professional sport, they have a sense for where their life and where their career is going and probably when it might come to an end. But take me through that decision to end your career and move on.
Well, it was pretty easy. I think everyone athlete has their sob story. And, you know, for me, it was I signed a contract with Arizona and I had twinged my hamstring. And because I had signed this contract and I, you know, wanted to prove myself as a leader, and I'd emerged as a leader over the past couple seasons before that. And we had a really young team at the time. I wanted to play through the injury, and I didn't tell the trainers about it or anything, and a twinged hamstring ended up basically cost me a year and a half because I eventually tore it off the bone. And then, you know, when you come back and you miss a year of baseball, it's tough. And when I came back, I wasn't soon after that I got hit in the hand with a Scott Feldman fastball and ended up shattering my hand. And finally, after all this time, played the month of September in like 2009 with the Diamondbacks, and then got released and signed with Seattle and had a great spring training, and ended up going up to Seattle. And the first month of the season was just an absolute disaster. I got like 33 at bats, I think it was 3 for 33 to end my career. And I just wasn't comfortable. I wasn't comfortable in a situation as a role player. I had a very difficult time being a bench player because I'm one of those athletes, I think, that just if you tell me to do something and you give me a chance to prepare for it and then do it and then repeat it, I'm pretty good. But if you say, hey, look, like, just go do this, and it's not natural. And so when you're not playing every day, you're not honing your skills and you're not facing live pitching, it becomes very difficult, and there's very few guys that can do it, and nobody really does it really well. But it's, you know, there are some guys that can do it and they can play that bench role. And so when I got released from Seattle, I had an opportunity. I had two job offers from clubs to go to AAA, and then I had another one to go call the college regionals with Kyle Peterson and Clay Matvick for ESPN. And I just knew at some point in my life, I wanted to make the transition to media. And I grew up, it wasn't like I grew up like all I want to do is play professional sports and that's it. And yada, yada. Like I grew up wanting to be a sports talk radio host. That's what I wanted to do. I listened to KMBR as a kid, Pete Franklin, Ralph Barbieri, like that's, I'm stimulated by debate, by controversy, by talking issues out, be it sports or whatnot. And so I knew I wanted to go that route. And I just figured that, you know, here I was at the time, I was 34 years old and I could hang on. I knew I could hang on and play it at least another 6 years. Just because I believed in my ability to physically keep myself healthy and in shape and able to do that. Yet at the same time, I also realized that, you know, if you do that, you're going to be 6 years behind the eight ball on, you know, starting a broadcasting career that you've always dreamed of doing. So I decided to make the switch, and you know, I don't think there's any doubt that I left some baseball on the table, but baseball to me, you know, it wasn't life. It wasn't everything like it is to some other guys.
You certainly are staying in touch with baseball because you're trying to make it better. The first computerized umpiring in professional baseball history you were involved with the San Rafael Pacifics and the Vallejo Admirals when they were playing in the Pacific Association Independent League. Now, people may not be familiar with it unless they saw the HBO Real Sports piece on this. Tell me a little bit about this system and what you're trying to do to try to make baseball better.
Well, this is something that that's been a passion of mine for a long time. And ever since the technology was available, like I always had issues with umpires in the sense that like these guys aren't perfect. And it wasn't an anger issue. I'd never been thrown out of a game. I can't necessarily even say that I ever felt like any umpire specifically was trying to screw me. But the bottom line is that they have a very difficult job. And so when I started my career as an analyst, is about the time that all of this information became available to us, and that's the information about the strike zone. And I learned about what was first the Quest technology and how they would grade umpires, and then later evolved to the Pitch FX, and that was created by Sports Vision. And so as I was, you know, diving into exactly like, okay, well, how do they track it? Why do they track it? You know, how accurate is it? I came up with this idea that, man, like, why can't we implement this and actually, you know, use this information to call balls and strikes? Like, why would we not do this? And I think the first thing, and like anything else in life and in this world, in order for us to be progressive and stay at the forefront, is we needed to test the technology. So we went ahead and implemented the technology. The great people at Sports Vision were very kind to let us do so, and came out there, and we actually tied it all around a Pat Tillman Foundation fundraiser. And we were able to raise a bunch of money for the Tillman Foundation, and we were also able to go ahead and show, I think, the baseball world that, hey, look, this would be a pretty seamless transition if they wanted to implement it in the future. And then, you know, not only did we do it once, everyone knows about it now because of the HBO Real Sports that came out, but we did it the year before, and it got some run, but it definitely didn't hit the hit the heart of the baseball fan until this season. And I think coupled with the HBO Real Sports piece and the blown calls of the postseason that were very evident and available on the TV screens, I'll tell you what, I would have told you, Ron, I think it'd be like 10 years off before something like this could possibly happen. And now I'm thinking that number's shrinking, and I think a lot more people are on board with letting technology get it right.
We've got about 3 minutes before we have to break again, and just so people know, it's three cameras that come into play. They're triangulated, and the other thing is that was brought out in the piece was that this system can be maybe an inch off while umpires can be a foot off. But I liked what I was interested in what the commissioner said, Rob Manfred. He said, I think we are a ways away from using technology to call balls and strikes. It's because, quite frankly, the strike zone is different for every single guy. But to me, that is the biggest argument to having something like this.
Well, here's Commissioner Manfred I might be wrong on this, Ron, but I feel like he's more on board with it than other people would believe. And I feel like he's saying the politically correct thing because he's dealing with an umpires union. But if you think about Commissioner Manfred in all the innovations that he's at least considering putting in when it comes to speeding the game up and you know, his ideas, and you know, they're at the forefront of the tech revolution. I mean, you know, what MLB has done, Bob Bowman and his staff at MLB.com, it's sensational. They sold, you know, I believe it was, you know, just part of the Major League Baseball, Baseball Advanced Media, for like $3 billion to Disney. Like these guys, you can't tell me they can't be on this immersed forefront of technology, and yet, you know, look at something like this and be against it. Now, what Commissioner Manfred did say is that, hey, the technology's not there, and that's the easy excuse when it wasn't there. But guess what? It's there. It's within a half an inch. So if you think of it, human error could be up to as much as a foot. and you have a machine that's able to do it up to a half inch. And it's just, look, I don't want robots playing the game. That's not it. I don't even want robots calling the game. The only thing I want is for us to give the information that we can have from a mobile phone 3,000 miles away from where the game is actually getting played, where I can tell you if it's a ball or a strike. I want the umpire who's right there in the midst of it and responsible for making the correct call to have that same information. We have a duty to give him that information. And if anything, we're creating jobs. I'm not taking any jobs away. Basically, my idea is to have another guy on site who would communicate the call with the umpire, which is what we did in our test this year. I actually got behind the plate and had a guy from Sports Vision telling me ball or strike on every single one.
In about 30 seconds, will this improve the game if they implement this technology, you think?
It just make the game more fair, and it's not. Look, I'll be the first to tell you, life's not fair. We don't live in this perfect society, this perfect world. But when we have games that are decided, in not only games, but I mean it's just from a player's perspective, man, millions and millions of dollars at stake with every strikeout and every base hit, and I just want it right. That's all we want. And if we don't have the technology, hey, look, great. Let the umpires go ahead and run with it. And hopefully, some guys are better than others and they make the right call. But in this case, now that the technology's there, I don't think there's any doubt. In my opinion, it would make the game better.
I agree with you. Eric Burns with us. We'll talk about his post-playing career and what he's doing next as we continue on Sports Byline. Eric Burns has joined us here on Sports Byline USA. Athletes always come to the end of their playing career, and they have to think about what lies ahead. For Eric Burns, now in his 40s, he's an elite endurance runner discovering a new passion, running 100-mile ultra-marathon races. And I loved a quote from you that I saw in an article. I thought a long run was going from first to third. How did you get into this?
Well, that's the truth, Ron. It really was. It's such an unnatural transition. And I think a lot of people, even people in the endurance world, they'll look at it and be like, oh, yeah, he was an athlete. Yeah, it makes total sense that, he's doing triathlons or running these ultra marathons. But, it couldn't have been a more unnatural transition. I had never run more than 4 miles in my life. I got into it basically because I ran into a couple junior high school friends of mine, the Ray sisters and Kevin Quomels, three of my best friends, growing up that I'd reconnected with, and they were going down. And this is right after I got done playing, and they were going down to do the Pacific Grove Triathlon, and they're like, hey, why don't you come with us? So Ron, I showed up. I had no idea what I was doing. I had never swam more than 25 yards in my life, never run more than 4 miles, like I mentioned. The only bike I owned was a beach cruiser. The race starts. I swear to you, I thought I was going to drown in the water. I got on the beach cruiser. I was getting past my 15-year-old girls. I end up running a couple quick miles, but it was – and this is just a sprint triathlon. And I got done, and they all kicked my ass, and they come to me, and they're like, what do you think? And I just said, you know what? I said, that was the greatest experience of my life. I said, thank you guys for introducing me to triathlon. And that's the last time any of you guys will ever beat me. And the next day I went out, I bought a triathlon bike. I ended up hiring a swim coach to have an idea and to hopefully, not drown in the water. And I ended up, working with a coach and to try to figure out how to run slower. And that was my biggest thing, is really trying to pull the reins back, because I was so used to just going, mock speed, and that was it. So the transition was very difficult. But 11 months after I did that first sprint, I ended up doing my first Ironman. And in a 4-year period, I did 8 Ironmans, now 9. I just did another one in November, but ultimately that transitioned into the ultra marathon world. And this past June, I completed the Western States 100, which is one of the most iconic ultra marathons in the world. And it was just a wild experience. And I was fortunate to have a documentary film crew. And really, they weren't a documentary film crew, but it was two guys that I had hired. And I realized, I'm like, man, this is my first, my shot at doing the Western States. And this race is just, you know, for anyone in the endurance world, it's sort of the Super Bowl of the endurance world. And I'm like, I'd love to have a couple guys like document it for me, so I don't have to worry about doing it on social media, this and that. And anyway, long story short, these dudes followed me around. Miles Smythe and Damian Gordon, they were awesome. Followed me around the whole race as I went through the process. And what I really thought I was going to have was sort of like an expensive home video and just a really cool thing. And what it transitioned to as we started realizing like what we had here was a documentary called Diamond to the Rough. And it, you know, we end up chronicling really, you know, how I went from playing Major League Baseball to the start line of the Western States 100, and then followed me through all the drama that happens in a 100-mile race, followed me through all of that. And we ended up with a product that I'm pretty damn proud of. We went to the Monarch Film Festival. We entered it. There are 100 of films submitted. We were one of the 34 films that were chosen for the Monarch Film Festival down in Pebble Beach. And we won the Judge's Choice Award, which the way it was described is like, hey, look, hundreds of films are submitted for this, 34 chosen. The Judge's Choice Award goes to the one film that we just can't stop talking about. And that was just pretty special. Of all the awards that I think I've ever won in my life, I would probably put that at the top, Ron.
And by the way, Diamond to the Rough is available for rental and purchase at Vimeo on demand. You might want to check it out. It's a pretty darn good piece. You have a special relationship with Lance Armstrong, though, as I was reading about it, putting aside the politics and all the things that have happened on a human basis, I found very, very insightful. And it said a lot, I think, about him as well as about you. Can you talk about that a bit?
Yeah, Lance is a guy, obviously very polarizing. And I think that, you know, Lance has made some dumb decisions in his life. You know, yet at the same time, you know, none of us ever lived Lance's life, and none of us really could relate or understand, what it's like, to be arguably the most, you know, famous athlete in the world. And then arguably, you know, the best athlete in the world. And then also on top of that, be a cancer survivor and have hundreds of millions of people watching your every move and looking at you like you're walking on water. And, you know, we were talking about the Livestrong bracelets. Like, he sold damn near 100 million Livestrong bracelets. So, you know, when it came to everything that went down with him, And not to mention the fact that he's in a culture, he's in a sport, which is just a horrific drug culture. I mean, we know that, and hopefully it's cleaned up since then, but, you know, who knows? I'm not making excuses for him, but it's tough to blame anybody who decided to use performance enhancing drugs in cycling at that time. And then the other thing is where he went wrong is he went on the attack. But when you think about what he was trying to protect, And not only, of course, there was a huge selfish element of his image, but it wasn't just his image. It was everybody who believed in him, and it was a whole Livestrong thing. And knowing that if he went down with this whole thing, there goes Livestrong. And guess what? There goes the faith of these cancer survivors and kids and everything else. And so if you wonder why he ever fought that hard, that's why he fought that hard. And I'm not, again, was it right? Hell no, it wasn't right. It was wrong. He knows it was wrong. I know it was wrong. But if you're ever to look back and think, how did this happen with what I consider as a very good dude, that's how it happened.
When you participated in the Western States 100, which, you, as you said, is a Super Bowl of endurance racing, he was right there beside you from mile 60 to mile 80. Tell me a little bit about how you two worked and what was the attraction for each other.
Well, Lance and I, we met playing golf and immediately just kind of hit it off. He likes to gamble. I like to gamble. And at the time, he was getting heavily into trail running. It's just, look, there's a different breed of people, I think, that can relate to say what Lance said this in the movie, and it's perfect. It's like, you know, there's, and it's not for everybody but some of us need this long, like a long day's run or a long day's ride. And when we say a long day, it's like literally like a long day. Like, you know, we'll go ride for, you know, 6 to 12 hours. You'll go run for, in Western States case, you know, it took me 22 hours. Like this is real stuff, but there's not everybody that relates to that. And immediately I think we clicked, because of that. And, you know, really to be a pacer at Western States, it's gotta be one of the most selfless jobs ever. You're running through the middle of the night, you're running through creeks, and you know, this is a race that not only is 100 miles, but it's 19,000 feet of elevation gain, 23,000 feet of descent. There's no zero glory in it. And it's not like even it's this super great workout for these guys, because by the time I see them at mile 60, my legs are so shot that really I'm looking at him and I'm like, man, dude, I can't go faster right now at this point. And so it just, you know what, Ron, he actually, and people, a lot of people have asked me, you know, so what'd you guys talk about? What'd you guys say? We talked about life. It was, I don't know, maybe imagine, you know, Ron, you and I doing this radio show together, and what would we talk about? We'd probably be pretty similar to the conversation we're having right now. And we sort of delved into all different walks of life. He's funny as could be. He had me cracking up 10 different times. And really, that's exactly what I needed at that point of the race, because I'd say mile 60 to 80, you know, I can make an argument. Those were the quote unquote, say, darkest, at least physically for me. Those were the darkest miles of the entire race.
You know, it's interesting. I used to date a woman who was an ultra marathoner, the 100-mile races, and it was amazing in talking to her, because I could not imagine somebody running from Sacramento to Reno, Nevada. I mean, I just could not imagine that. And the one thing I came away with, and I'd like your insight on this, obviously physical capability is important in something like that, but the discipline of the mind during that, because as you get further into the race, it's almost, you know, your mind goes crazy. You have to keep it focused in order to go on. How did you train your mind to be able to stay focused and not worry about the body's performance?
I think that it's something that's developed. It's funny because, so if I go and train, like say this morning, I hopped on the treadmill and I ran like 5.5 miles, and from start to finish, I was on the phone with a buddy of mine for like the first half hour. Then after that, I was listening to a book on tape. And then if I go train, and I go on a long bike ride, I immediately from start to finish, I'll either be listening to a book on tape, or I'll be listening to music. And there's something about racing that I had music on me, and you are allowed to listen to music. You are not in Ironman triathlons, but you are in the Western States in ultramarathons. I didn't turn it on once. I had this music on me, and I just didn't turn it on. And I think what happens, and this is really kind of one of the key points of the movie, is that it's not about the reward. The reward is a process. And the process is really what life is about. So to be out there and to be racing and going through the process, and to be out there with other runners. But I mean, I went through a stretch of probably 15, 20 miles. I think, you know, leading into mile 60, where I hardly saw anybody, and I was out there on my own, but I was strategizing, and it was not only the one foot in front of the other, when I wasn't feeling great, but watching my feet, where were they going, playing with my pacing, practicing, you know, and not practicing, but just delving into the technical part of what it takes to run. I'll tell you what, it was one of the most incredible experiences, if not the most incredible experience of my life, but it's such a microcosm for life. And the other guy that paced me from 80 to 100 was Franz Dill, and he completed the race four times. And he had told me, he's like, you're going to live a lifetime in a day. And I didn't really know what that meant. And I'm, you know, I'd done 8 Ironmans to that point, and I'd done a bunch of ultra marathons, and I'd never done a 100-mile race, but I'd done 100K as a qualifier. And I still couldn't grasp that concept of like, what does he mean about the lifetime in the day? And then you go through it. And I walked away from it going, that's exactly what it was. It was a lifetime and a day, and just going through, you know, not only the physical ailments, but the emotional roller coaster, and then ultimately walking away and coming out of it, just thinking, man, what an awesome, awesome experience.
Yeah, we've got about 30 seconds left, so I need to ask you, what sense of satisfaction did you get with your baseball career or even doing these ultra marathons and when it was over with?
I don't, you know what, it's, I'm going to go back to what sort of what I said earlier, is that it's not the satisfaction that when it's done. It's not about that. It's not about it being over and looking back and saying, hey, look, I played 11 seasons in the big leagues and, you know, hit 100-something homers and stole 100-something bases and you know, or I did this race and I finished in 22 hours, or I did this Ironman and, finished 10 hours. Like, results are the results. And it's okay to have goals and set goals and chase them, you know, even if they're time-oriented goals. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But if you're not getting fulfilled when you're out there, if you're not letting that pain talk to you, if you're not letting that resonate with you, you're missing the point.
Eric Burns with us, double-digit years in Major League Baseball and still continuing his life very successfully. We continue on Sports Byline.